often address the why. Why do we practice? And in a certain way, Charles addressed this question yesterday. We practice for freedom. Freedom from unnecessary suffering. Today, I'd like to address the how. How we practice. Many of you had questions in the interviews about understanding it, but still not quite understanding how to do it. And especially with the thoughts and the emotions. So my talk this afternoon will be around working with thoughts and emotions. It's an essential part of our practice. Now, if we have a path of transformation, there's in a sutra, meaning an original text, the path is kind of summed up in three aspects. One is to avoid to do oneself and another any harmful actions by thought, speech, and body. So this is, of course, the whole path of what we call sila, which is the path of morality, of ethics. A very important aspect, actually, of the path to be able to live in peace with ourselves and with one another. The second aspect is to cultivate the good, meaning the practice of metta and of compassion, loving kindness, generosity, all the beautiful qualities of heart and mind that we can naturally see grow in ourselves in relationship to ourselves and to other beings. So avoiding doing harm and cultivating the beneficial, right? So they go together. And naturally, the third part is to liberate one's own mind. Sometimes you see the translation of purifying, as if we needed purification. But I like the term liberation much better, because I think it's in relationship to entanglement that we suffer and not seeing clearly. So this is the aspect of the meditation itself. And of course, we have the mindfulness and the wisdom that sharpen in ourself so that we can really see clearly. So this is really kind of the whole picture of a path of Dharma, a path of leading to the truth. Now, most of us come to meditation for this third aspect, right? To understand, to clearly see what is happening. And all of the three are actually interwoven. Because if we kind of do harm to ourselves on a daily basis, then when we will be in the face of our own being, of our own heart, we are not going to have a peaceful mind or heart. We're, of course, going to be probably restless or agitated due to that fact. So there's why the Buddha really emphasized that we need to understand the cause and effect factors, that it's one whole. It has to do with everything we actually act, do, and think. And through thoughts, there can be extremely beneficial thoughts that help us go through our lives and in our meditation process. And sometimes there are thoughts that are not so helpful. And we begin to see the difference. I mean, really, I think that because we're so intimate And we're in this situation probably like never before. I mean, have you sat with yourself so intensively from morning to afternoon, walked with yourself, by yourself? I don't think so. Right? So there's a real sense of purpose of becoming so intimate that we begin to really have a sense, whether we want it or not, at times, the practice just puts you in front of, wow, this thought and this thought. And I remember being kind of so taken aback by the actual thoughts that were starting to emerge on that very weekend that I started, that it was really quite interesting to see the effect. And it's totally normal that we want to avoid ourselves at times, because not all of it is very nice to see, quite frankly. And yet, these are patterns. See, we don't need to own the thoughts constructs. So many of the patterns are actually not coming from a place of understanding and depth. They're really habit. And what I really began to see is that at a deeper level, it's ideas, ways of seeing life, cultural ways of seeing life through the eyes of someone else. Living under influence. And so it was so revealing for me to see that, you know, some of the ideas that we receive, or I should say I receive as a child, were kind of coming into the field of my own being and saying, wow, you know, there's a need for some clarification here. Do I really want to follow this idea, this view that Lila was talking about 2 days ago? You know, there's a choice. When we begin to have a space where we are in the face of ourselves, part of the liberation is to see, oh, clarifying the ideas that we may have. And so a lot of this mind development is really to learn how to relate to these patterns in a new way, with balance and compassion, rather than just relive other beings' patterns or ideas. And this is great. Already to reframe, and it is a reframing, right? Another frame on our understanding. So in the Dhammapada, again, a very old text, it says, an untrained mind does more harm than any enemy does to an enemy. Can you imagine? An untrained mind does more harm than an enemy to another enemy. A well-trained mind does more good for you than any of your helpful relatives. What's so amazing is that I really took it to heart, and actually I practiced a whole month with these two lines, reflecting deeply what it means. So when you hear me say reflecting, you think, okay, then if she was reflecting, she was thinking, using thoughts. And yes, there are moments when I think it's very beneficial to understand that even though we are not kind of being in a space where we lose sight of getting caught up in the thoughts, but we do have a sense when these patterns come up, when there is kind of a sense of entanglement, we begin to also have what is called the reflective understanding. Understanding, wisdom that's based in also reflection. From a place of awareness, from a place of steady mind, so that we can see what emerges. It doesn't mean that we're lost in the content here, but we actually have a deep listening. And I love that word of deep listening. Deeply listening to the words that are coming from a place where we're connected, right? So a well-trained mind does more good for you than any of your helpful relatives. For me, it really meant, and I explored the saying with the understanding and the interest to have the mind become a friend. May my mind be my friend rather than the enemy. And to make one's mind one's friend, I can tell you, will bring you a very deep peace. Because your relatives are sometimes with you, and they can do very good things for you. But they're not always with you, right? Your mind is, right? Everywhere you are, your mind is going along with you. So to make my mind a friend requires quite some training. And this is part of the exploration, right? So how do we do this? There's no doubt that we need a certain steadiness in our attention, right? It's not from a place of restless mind, agitation, or being totally lost in distraction that we can begin to sense what it is that is happening. So we begin where we are. This is where we start, and often we start with a totally scattered mind. And it's just a question of training. Not long ago, my sister, she's much younger than I, and she still has children, and they decided to have a puppy. And it's a very sweet puppy, but it's a wild puppy. And it really likes to play and run, and it's just normal. That's what puppies do. But she wants to train the puppy, you know, and it's so fascinating. So she's kind of not very patient with the puppy. And it may be just see, you know, the way that we actually treat our minds, that, you know, you tell your mind to stay once, and we think, okay, it's done, and it just won't obey. So you react in relationship to your mind. If you have the image of a puppy, and you ever had kind of a sense of training in relationship to an animal, you'll know that it will take just more than a few days, right? It takes patience, it takes allowance. So this is exactly the same way. The mind, kind, the mental word, the attention needs to be cared for. So there's a little bit of steadiness. But what is so amazing is that when we begin to sense kind of the feeling of being connected, right? And being where we are, actually there's a collectedness, not a concentration, but a collectedness. You feel much more in tune, in alignment with what is happening. And it feels good. And the mind likes it. There's a liking of that quality. So after some time, rather than always wanting somewhere else, we actually begin to sense that there's an interest in bringing the mind home. And to make the mind a friend, it's really to bring it home. Home meaning where we are. Right? Feeling at home within itself. And there's no doubt that our lifestyles, the way we live our life, you know, very scattered and restless and doing million things in a day, accomplishing, of course, just gets ourselves running all the time. So not only is the training helpful here, but when we do go home, a part of it is also to emphasize and to have kind of an interest to stay in connection. And it's all that's needed is that we stay in connection. It's not more than that. So we learn to really connect, and then this clear seeing, this sense of really noticing the patterns or what the thoughts say begin to emerge all by themselves. You know, we're intelligent. And as my teacher, one of my teachers, Ayodhya Tijiniya, would say, he says, don't think that it's just attention. It's an intelligent awareness that we're developing. There is intelligence in this awareness because it changes, it modifies our way of seeing life and our own inner life as well. And so this is a cause not for suffering, but for greater happiness. The happiness comes from the clear seeing. And a lot of this development is happening through being a little more interested in this field, which seems so more complex than the field of the body sensations. But it is a field which is happening. I mean, it's part of our reality to meet the thoughts and the emotions. This is our human predicament, that we can be aware of that field. Very rich. So why put it aside? Why stay only with the body sensations when we can really understand deeply what we think and also what we think is a cause for our actions, right? We apply the actions, yet before acting, there's thinking. So there's clearly a connection between the two. Here are a few lines. It's called the human predicament. One of the great misfortunes of being a human being is how we suffer being at the mercy of our minds. Incessant thoughts and emotions, paralyzing fears, obsessive desires, a chaotic inner turbulence of mind. But one of the great blessings of the human predicament, of being a human, and this is very different from other life species, right, is having a way to work with these minds so that they can be freed from unnecessary suffering. This is very special, you know. Of all species, animals don't have this way of kind of a capacity to transform their very life in a way of seeing exactly what is the cause. So the trouble comes from our own minds. The suffering that the Buddha is speaking about is not only due to conditions, outer conditions, but how we treat these conditions. And there's a story that if you've been on retreat with me, you might have heard before, but since many of you are new, I'm going to tell the story again, because it's so clear and it's great. It's the story of a Chinese painter being in a cave, and he is painting a very beautiful big tiger. It really is very beautiful. It's got whiskers, it's got the stripes. It takes hours for him to paint this tiger. And once he looks at the beautiful painting that he has just created, and looking at it, he's totally afraid, and he runs away. This is how we create whole universes, whirlwinds, earthquakes, tsunamis, in relationship to how we inhabit our minds. these thoughts become real. In the same way that when we look at the painting, we look at the story, it is a very real story for us because we inhabit it. We don't have clear seeing. We don't have the appropriate awareness. There isn't intelligent awareness. So we really are lost in the belief this is true. And this is how we live a lot in imagination, not realizing that actually it's a construct. There's a world of thought based on reality, but which becomes huge. And more so today, is it going to be that we are kind of so trapped by the virtual world? Can you imagine how much of our life is spent in the virtual, right? These machines, they really trap us, you know, and no doubt they're very engaging. Yet, it's not helpful in relationship to what we can create, the universe, with thought. So we believe these thoughts are the truth. And that's where we begin to question, is this thought the truth? Or is it a story I tell myself? It's so helpful to begin to sense the power of that question, to really investigate. And so we understand the practice to be based in calm, in tranquility. And a part of it is based in calm and tranquility, because I think we need to have this sense of kind of composed mind and field of presence to deepen, in a way, our clear seeing, that we're not all up in our heads. But it's not only about calm. There's a huge part of the practice where there is an interest. And this is what is meant by intelligent awareness. There is a quality of investigation. And actually, there's a word for this, Dhamma Vichaya. Investigate the Dhamma. And the investigation, then you say, okay, but if I investigate, if I'm asked to investigate, it means I need to analyze. I need to think about, right? This is how usually we investigate. It's not done in this way. Investigation comes from just an interest. It's done when we examine exactly what is happening from the place of awareness. We investigate in a way that we see thought for thought. And so we don't kind of get lost into the trap of the belief. From the place of interest, from the place of nothing else than just heightening the awareness. And this, of course, takes practice. So many people think, you know, that we need to get rid of the thoughts to be able to be peaceful. Well, it can happen this way, because as the mind will think, we need to have a relationship much more wise, you can say, than just thoughts out. And actually, we're not very successful when we say thoughts out. It can be something that we succeed for maybe 10 minutes, 15 minutes, right, due to concentration. But then what did we learn? We didn't learn much. So it's about learning in relationship to the mind. And yet, when we begin to open this field, then we are really very reactive to the thinking mind. And it's normal. We react. As I said earlier, we don't like so much what they say. So it's a very balanced way of being with, meaning that we stay tuned and we see when we want to smash the thoughts with a hammer. We really begin to see and look at the attitude. So it's done with care, with kindness, with gentleness, in the best way that we can. If there's reactivity, this is where we need to look. I don't want the thought. this thought. I want another thought. So this is where the practice is happening. This is exactly, it's not that you should be with the thoughts and just accept. It's, I don't want to be with this thought. I don't like this thought. And so you really are interested in the not liking. And it's part of the process where you cultivate also an interest, an investigation in the relationship. You see? Why do we do this? To understand its nature. So it's our ability to see through the story and to actually understand that the nature of a thought is no more than a bubble in a stream. In itself, it's not much. It's insubstantial. It's ephemeral. It's so quick. Right? And there's a beautiful teaching that says, a thought is like a bubble in a stream or a snowflake that melts on a pond. As soon as it appears, whoop, it disappears. And when we begin to have a little bit of steadiness, meaning that you are interested in the mindfulness is steady. This is what we're actually trying to get to, that the mindfulness is steady. You begin to be aware of the arising and the passing of the thoughts. And you are at home. The thoughts lose their power. You stay at home. It's quite fantastic when this is an inner experience, that you really taste that experience for the first time. Not long ago, this summer, we taught a 3-week retreat in Italy, and it was great because a few of these meditators over 3 weeks, I can tell you, you really are in a space where, you know, already a week. It's so much more than a weekend. But you go through these waves of, wow, seeing so much and then losing it. And then, again, seeing and then losing it, you know. And it's just not linear, but it's so great because this meditator came to me and said, how can it be? I want to work with the thoughts. As soon as I see one, it's gone. It was so sweet. It was his first retreat, so it was amazing that it's a funny story, actually. I'm going to tell you the story. It's just a little bit for fun. There were 4 friends, and the plan was to go to Costa Rica. Better than meditation retreat. On a level. And so the 3 friends got a seat because they were cheap seats to Costa Rica. And unfortunately, something got messed up with his air ticket. He never got to Costa Rica. And so he said, well, what else can I do during 3 weeks? And then another friend told him, oh, but it's even better. Go meditate for three weeks. And so this is how he ended up here. And I remember telling him at the end of the 3 weeks, the last day, I said, so did it do up to Costa Rica in your mind? And he said, much better, much better. And so I said, well, good job. So it's totally amazing because it's true that, wow, he came out. And I tell you, he didn't have, like, you know, all the time a fun time. But he was just noticing how, with the working of the mind, there was such an ability to not be taken by it all the time and to have a sense of steadiness, because this is exactly what grows. It's our capacity to make space for what is emerging. It's not that the thoughts are no longer here. It's really this inner experience where as much as they can shape our entire world and create universes usually quite dramatic, sometimes funny, hopefully, but it's not that it changes. What changes is that we have a much greater capacity and spaciousness to welcome it all and to see it for what it is. So we're not kind of straining or struggling for them to go away or believing in them. So this happens over time. With practice, there's really a lightness of heart. And it feels lighter. It's not forever because it's a path. And every path, you know, will have a journey. Like when you go to the top of the mountain, right? There are moments you're full of energy and there are moments you need to rest. There are moments where you kind of run into obstacles, right? There's stones on the path, difficulties, and other moments it's smooth and you go along and whoa, you're full of excitement. So this path has also all these different valleys and hills, as we call them. And everything comes along in its own time. So, there's a way that one thought linked to another thought creates a story. And the Buddha named this. And the Pali name I really liked. It's called Papancha. You know? Papancha, Papancha, Papancha. This is exactly what we can call the chatterbox, right? Papancha. It's thoughts linked with each other. They proliferate, right? But it's true that it begins with one, right? It really begins with one. And so when we are more steady in our mindfulness, we can actually, at times, begin to see the arising of that thought. And then we have a choice. Whoa, this story, I know where this one is going. Because of course we have our favorite tunes, right? And our favorite 10 tunes, usually, especially on a retreat, wow, not so much. I also think at times, I don't have so much imagination. This one again. This pattern again. I can't believe I've seen this 10 times. It's here again, see? So this is the proliferation. So, right, it's called the snowball effect. The more the snowball kind of rolls down the hill, the bigger it gets. Maybe you haven't seen snow, I don't know. No, you see snow. That's my example, but that's what happens, you know? It's just like a ball and then it becomes huge. And this is exactly how we create a universe. So it proliferates. Whoa, big, big, big. And what happens? We end up with a drama. And then, of course, we're totally not stable, right? There's the drama, right? And then the emotions come along, of course, right? It's, we're overwhelmed by the thoughts. Because thoughts, when they are really having a pattern, what happens? There's an emotion beneath them, right? Even maybe more than one emotion. So there's a cluster of emotions. So this is when we begin to actually work with both levels. But to come back to what was I saying, there's a real sense that it begins with a thought. We don't have any pattern at all. We're just present with a very simple body sensation, right? Not too bad. Suddenly, ooh, it's a little painful. I've had this so many times. A little bit of pain in the knee. Then the thought, oh, should I move? Should I stay? That's the first thought. Oh no, I think I can stay. And then next thought, I'm going to finish in hospital. If I stay, I'm sure I'm going to be in a wheelchair for the rest of my life. It's not even in hospital, the injury, you know. And there's the drama. But we laugh because each one of us, I'm sure, has had this happen, right? And so one moment before, we just had this little sensation that we can call pain in our body. That's the reality. Now, it doesn't mean that you're not supposed to move. It's a good question to ask. Should I move or should I stay? To what extent? Intelligent awareness, you know? You're not a fool. So it means maybe the appropriate thing is to check in the emotional world. Like, okay, is there fear? Because it is a fearful thought. And then if there's fear in that realm of experience, much better to move. Because what happens? Then you increase the fear, right? And you can't be balanced. You can't be mindful. Right there, you're totally restless, agitated, and you're trying to force yourself to stay in that very situation, which is totally imbalanced. So you respect yourself. That is also intelligent awareness. There's a lot of respect and care. And that's very different from the should that needs to stay with whatever is. Who cares if you move? Oh, but my self-image. What will I look like if I move? Right? This is exactly another construct. Who am I when I move? I'm not the perfect meditator. Right? That's the story, the belief. It's just so great. I mean, to begin to watch this whole show, it's much better than going to the movies. And more interesting because it's our own, of course, you know, story. And so we see, we begin to really have life in this process where we're engaged from being in a passive mode of thinking we need to take it all in, right? That it being mode means to be with, to surrender, or I don't know what image you have. There's an engagement. There's really a participation with intelligence, that we have wisdom. It's wise mindfulness. Mark Twain has this wonderful line. He says, "My life has been filled with terrible misfortunes, most of which never happened." And of course, there are dramas in life. I'm not saying that there are not, right? I mean, we have our load, each one of us, right? That's not what I'm talking about. But because of that, why add the unnecessary? What for? For which purpose? To stay entangled in suffering? That's not the Buddha's invitation, right? I mean, we can really sense that there's a possibility of power, of lighting up, right? So mindfulness breaks these patterns and these ways we have to be so obsessed by the thinking mind and by the emotional life. So this is a freedom from thinking and being lost in thought, being lost in the construct, and it happens one moment. It's not forever. We also need to be realistic here, right? And often there's disappointment or despair or kind of hopelessness, like, oh, I did this and I saw it yesterday. Why is it coming again? Well, unfortunately, we revisit very often the same patterns, the same conditioning. Just imagine how many years of habit, of construct, of conditioning we have that we haven't seen. Years. This is why to start young is great. And many of you are young, right? But if you're a little older like I am, don't be desperate. No hopelessness, because any moment of freedom is really a moment of true freedom. And this has a true taste. So it's often that we grow in despair and kind of disappointment, because the meeting is one that, okay, I understood that, right? But maybe the next sitting, it's not all done. We're not baked. We're half baked, right? So we really need to, okay, go through this process again and again. And this is where we need the acceptance, the patience, the care, and the kindness. It takes the time that it will take, because there's a lot of tangles. Yet, there's a truth in that moment of freedom, which is that we are liberated. We see clearly. And that has a lot of power. So this is the way, my friends. Making friends with all of ourselves. Everything. Everything that can come along. And then we can cultivate an understanding of our own emotions. The emotional life is yet another cluster, which requires some respect. Emotions are, it's kind of a coloration of what happens in the mind, right? There's a thought, and we say, okay, this is sad. So we have a thought, and there's a way that there's also an emotion aspect where there's a mind state of sadness in consciousness. It colors. But it's, again, impermanent, right? And when we begin to see that that emotion is in our being, it colors not only our own being, but the whole world. We see through the glasses of sadness, because just sadness is present. And then the construct is, oh my gosh, the world looks so miserable today. Everybody looks so sad. It's depressing, you know? It's fascinating to see, right? How, because we have this coloration in our own being, we see everything like that very clear glass that we have in relationship to sadness. In the same way that maybe the next day we're in a good mood and there's joy and we just feel more light. Wow, the world's beautiful. The world's the world. It's not beautiful or sad. It's what it is. So how much do we project on other beings, on the world, on nature, the way that we see? It's totally fascinating to notice that. So this is how we get trapped, and we begin to also sense that, of course, these emotions have an effect in the body. And it's helpful to relate to the emotional life on the level also of the effect in the body. Because this is, has kind of some matter, right? There's kind of material element. Huh? So you can feel. And it's maybe easier to stay stable in the body. But it's fine. Either way. You can see the mind. You can see what happens in the body. So this is all an investigation. So the last thing I'd like to say is that it needs to be an exploration done with a lot of love. The metta that we did last night is that type of love. It's an unconditional kindness. And this is what metta is about. This totally unconditional, meaning whatever condition, I can bring kindness rather than judgment. And I tell you, it's going to make a difference. If you call forth really a sense of kindness, which at times is nothing else than respect. We respect ourselves. We respect our being. We respect the resistances. It doesn't mean indulge. It means a respectful attitude. We honor our being because we are alive. And this life has a deep meaning for us. So not only do we want to waste it, but we want to ask ourselves, how are we treating ourselves? And it starts right here. In the way that we treat ourselves, then very clearly we also treat others. This is from Rilke. Have patience with everything unresolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves as if they were locked rooms or books written in a very foreign language. Means we don't know the words, right? Don't search for the answers which could not be given to you now, because you would not be able to live them. That's the quality of patience. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps then someday, far in the future, you will gradually, without even noticing it, live your way into the answer. So this is a process. There's a path. Respect, appreciate, love the fact that there is a path, a journey. We don't need to feel rushed. Respecting, treating ourselves with a lot of care so we explore the whole of our life and then our heart can open. I'll end with a poem from Jennifer Wellwood. It's called Unconditional. Willing to experience aloneness, which definitely we are experiencing here, aloneness. It's not loneliness, right? It's a sense of solitude. Willing to experience aloneness, I discover connection everywhere. Turning to face my fear, I meet the gentle warrior who lives within. Opening to my loss, I gain the embrace of the universe. Surrendering into emptiness, I find fullness without end. Each condition I flee from pursues me. Each condition I welcome transforms me and becomes itself transformed into its radiant, jewel-like essence. I bow to the one who has made it so, who has crafted this master game. To play, it is purest delight, to honor its form. This is true devotion. Jennifer well would. So there's a quality of devotion. Devotion to the practice, devotion to mindfulness, devotion to the care. To the truth. To our own nature. That is all. And it's a lot. Thank you.